Our college campus is a kangaroo court for Title IX. Title IX covers a lot. Some want it to cover less. We'll cover it all. Plus, cones, zone, let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From the Tennessean, it's part of the USA Today Network. Two Nashville lawsuits reflect a new chapter in the debate over how colleges respond to sexual assault claims, echoing concerns over Title IX outlined this month by Betsy DeVos. President Donald Trump's education secretary announced plans to overhaul federal rules surrounding Title IX, the federal law that guides campuses on sexual discrimination and violence responses. Those plans have prompted criticism, but also some support. Her concerns that administrative discipline procedures unfairly disadvantage students accused of sexual assault are evident in Nashville, where two of the city's most prominent universities are embroiled in legal battles defending their Title IX investigations.
Well, so here we are. We're looking at this Title IX, and first of all, Title IX for a lot of people who think that this has to do with women's sports.
Yes.
Also, just a quick informative, it also deals with colleges and their need to protect everybody from sexual assault and sexual discrimination. So that's all under Title IX.
The victims and the accusers.
Victims and the accusers. Yeah. But here we're saying in this case, there's two prominent cases in Tennessee where two students were accused of sexual misconduct. And it has now been brought forward that maybe we might want to look into these cases because there are issues that may have tainted and or made the accused look like they were guilty when the reality is that they weren't guilty, or it's never been fully actually adapted. So we'll take a look. September 11th, they said, in Belmont University, John Doe. Now, obviously, that's not Mr. Doe. That's John Doe, the name we give to the person we don't want to know who they are.
Exactly.
Okay, but John Doe did something. A female said that John Doe did something to her, was later found out that she, at least in the hearings, that everything was not as cool or as bad as she said it was. But he did get thrown out of school anyway because he lied in the proceedings. And now we're going to come back and go, well, why didn't the girl get kicked out? Because didn't she lie about the sexual assault then?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting perspective. And so maybe we should take another look at that. And so this is this Title IX and reopening and looking at the cases that are unsolved. The other, then we take another look down and go further and see that Vanderbilt. And we've got another possibility of a false accusation. Okay. And the DeVos Secretary of Education, their administration, is using these two examples in Tennessee as justification for why, quote, as the title points out, why we're going to take a new look at how Title IX is enforced on campuses, because there's a debate going on as to whether or not we're wrongfully accusing, what do you want to say, the rapers.
The accuser.
The accused. The accused.
Yeah.
And the kangaroo courts and things like that have been put up and brought up that this is the way it's handled on campus, and this is unfair to people accused of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. Okay. It will be interesting to see how this plays out because, as we said, here are two examples that have some ambiguity that point out the fact that maybe we should take a look at the way Title IX is prosecuted on campuses across the country. However, there are critics, and we'll get to that later.
From Hilltop Views, Trump administration unfit to rewrite Title IX regulations. Recently, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos announced plans to rewrite the rules regarding the policy of sexual assault on college campuses across the country, claiming that the Obama-era policies on this issue had failed too many students by making campuses overreach in their efforts to punish those accused of sexual assault. DeVos remarked that one rape is one too many, one assault is one too many, one aggressive act of of harassment is one too many. One person denied due process is one too many.
And who could disagree with those statements, right?
Right. Those are very – everybody wants to stand behind those. You're right.
And let's first recognize that I'm sure Betsy DeVos herself did not write those lines, okay?
Okay.
Just for the hell of it, because she's not I don't think she's capable, but as they all have speechwriters, let's be honest,
they
here
do.
On Busted
they
Pencils.
Do.
We
yeah.
know politicians
we
have
know.
Speechwriters. But this is a really nicely crafted statement when you're about to do something. And that's the issue here. Then we were talking about this in the last news story about some look like probably in Tennessee, some possibly falsely accused students who suffered ramifications because of being accused of sexual assault. Okay, now both of those universities in the Tennessean article claimed and still stand by what they did was right. But here is more of an opinion piece saying, look, as the DeVos Secretary of Education Administration is about to rewrite the federal rules, isn't it wonderful how she comes out with this claim that one rape
is one
too many and one person falsely accused is one too many? Well, yes, of course that mm-hmm. is. Okay. But the issue comes into play here is what she's going to do, though, and you run deeper into this article and anybody else who's going to spend more time looking at Title IX. The right, particularly the right, has characterized Title IX enforcement on college campuses as, quote, kangaroo courts. And so if you're accused of sexual assault, you're guilty. Okay, then that's just the way it is on all college campuses, and damn it, something has to be done about it. And Betsy DeVos is here to fix that. Now, she's not going to take those truly raped people and dismiss them, because that's serious stuff.
That's wrong too.
That's wrong. But we can't have all these, and let's be honest, we can't have all these 19 to 24 year old men walking around with rape labels on their head.
Right.
If they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I can't disagree with the premise here, but we'd have to actually look in and say, how often is this really happening? And is the Title IX enforcement on college campuses truly a kangaroo court system? Is it a mess? Is there a ton of falsely accused students out there? What do the statistics say?
So who handles the cases? Is it always the campus police that handle it?
Well, and so you depending on how campuses are arranged, there's typically a way that this works, but on a college first, it's a student violation of the code of conduct.
Okay.
And so the first on Title IX specifically does not deal with the criminal complaint. It deals with the issue of how a college must enforce if somebody says, I was accused or I was assaulted sexually.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. Title IX says you have to investigate that. That's all it does. It says you have to investigate that. And so what has come out, though, is that, yeah, we've got this rampant runaway system of falsely accused people that have their lives ruined. And the statistics on that, though, are just not there. They don't bear that out. When you survey and look at deans of students, when you take a look at the number of, quote, sexual assault cases that were heard by deans and or deans of students or the counterparts at other colleges, the number of these cases that are solved and never make it to criminal court because of false accusations is very, very, very minuscule. However, you do have to agree that one falsely accused is a problem. Mm-hmm. But we also need to look at and go, is there a problem that needs to be undone in this law? Does this law need to have a looser regulation? According to the statistics, and in fact, one of the people you're going to meet later on in this show, a dean of students who we talked to, it's a hyperinflation of false accusation that's actually being used by this administration, the Trump administration, to roll back some of the progress that we've made in protecting sexual assault victims.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
The teachers our children deserve. Let's be very clear. Number one, there is no teacher shortage. Number two, there is a teacher exodus. And number three, loosening, tinkering, and doing away with teacher licenses will do nothing for the shortage. It will kill the profession of teaching and dramatically increase systemic inequity. Yeah, it's happening all across the country. Policymakers, pundits, and idiots keep screaming teacher shortage, and in the same breath advocating and putting forth policies that do away with teacher licensing. Why? Well, first the BS answer. Allowing license flexibility or doing away with teaching licenses altogether will fix the shortage. And hey, you know, if we don't do something fast, children will face empty classrooms. The truth? Softening teacher license policies or doing away with the license altogether will kill the profession of teaching. It's that simple. Yet trying to get media and policymakers to understand this seems almost impossible. Trust me, I've been trying for 4 months. But I have an idea. Instead of simply just bitching about what's wrong, I'm going to do something novel today. I'm going to put forward a solution. A solution in the form of model legislation that can be used across the country. Yes, I'm going to do an ALEC on ALEC. Here it is. Ready? Let me introduce House Bill 2675. I'm joking, of course. Look, if we can learn anything from education reformers and policymaking, it's claiming the moral high ground right from the start by giving legislation a title and not a stupid and meaningless number. That's what matters. Remember Goals 2000? No Child Left Behind? Race to the Top. All ridiculous. But if you dared come out against any of them, you look like an idiot. Remember, hey, dude, you mean to tell me you want to leave kids behind or you got something against kids getting to the top? Hey, time to switch it up. Today, I propose the Teachers Our Children Deserve Act. Simple. All of our children deserve a fully qualified, licensed teacher that has gone through an awesome education program designed to awaken the passion to teach. And if there happens to be a shortage, then this legislation will provide the funding to school districts and teacher education programs that form a mutual partnership that uses a model for teacher recruitment called Grow Your Own. Well, what's Grow Your Own? It's simple. Take our brightest and best teachers, they're already in our communities. Actively recruit them, bring them into teacher education school district partnerships, fully funded. It's that simple. The so-called shortage will die as our children finally get the teachers they deserve. Now, it's up to you. Take this message. Call your legislators. Call your local media. Chain yourself to a tree naked. Well, you might want to do that and check the weather. But you must do something. It's that serious. Don't allow ALEC-sponsored legislation, teacher license decimation, to create even more inequity that will harm our most vulnerable children. No. Demand the teachers our children deserve.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
He was previously a professor of history and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Fairfield University and former chief historian of the Jackie Robinson Foundation. He's an education activist and noted scholar about the civil rights movement and black power movement. He's currently the dean of College of Arts and Sciences at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. Welcome back to Busted Pencils, Dr. Yahuru Williams.
Hey, Tim, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great, but before we get into this interview, how many damn TV shows have I seen you on in the past year and a half?
It's been a lot.
Man, every time I got on the History Channel or National Geographic or something, I'm sitting there going, I'm like, hey, my son Luke, you know, he's a senior in high school. I said, that's Yahuru. I said, I know that. He's been on Busted Pencils. And finally, my son even said one day, he goes, hey, Dad, guess what? I saw your buddy on TV the other day.
But here's the thing, though, Tim. The only thing that counts that's actually significant is being on Busted Pencils.
Well, that's hey, when it comes to the true media outlet, Busted Pencils is your number one spot, and we really appreciate you coming back. You know, we're into, what, how many months of the Trump administration and the Betsy DeVos ruling of the Department of Education, and God forbid all the problems we have with somebody who's absolutely unqualified to be in that position. But the latest, just kind of like, really, you got to be kidding me. She's going after Title IX. And before we even go any further, though, somebody might say, well, Tim, what the hell is Title IX?
It's a good question, Tim. And it's one of these things that I think the reason that so many people aren't alarmed by it is they don't realize the significance of Title IX. Title IX on its surface has nothing to do with sexual assault. It simply requires that schools that receive federal funds not discriminate on the basis of sex. And most of the times when we hear about Title IX, we hear about it in regards to college athletics. The idea that if a school supports a male athletic team, then they have to, under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, under the dictates of Title IX, do the same thing for women's sports. So while the law itself does not mention sexual violence, it has been interpreted by the courts and by the Department of Education since about 1972 to ban sex discrimination on school. And it also requires schools, universities to address sexual violence among students, that is to take proactive measures to ensure that there are provisions in place to deal with sexual assault and sexual discrimination.
So the current President Trump, who likes to grab kitty cats, if he would have done that on a college campus, he would have been subject to Title IX.
Absolutely. And this is kind of the interesting thing about this whole situation, Tim, because part of what Betsy DeVos has argued is that Title IX has gone too far. And in the speech that she gave at George Mason University, part of what she echoed is something that her civil rights or one of Trump's civil rights advocates had talked about a few months ago, and that was the idea that most sexual assaults on campus weren't actually sexual assaults. They were the consequence of kind of drunken kid activity and breakup sex is what she called it. And, you know, I believe that woman's name was Candace Jackson. The problem with that, obviously, Tim, is that that's an interpretation of sexual assault that's problematic because it trivializes what has become an epidemic on college campuses across the United States and on high school campuses. And really what you are or what most people are concerned about in this is that when you suggest, as Betsy DeVos did, that only between 2% and 8% of sexual assault reports are accurate, that's a huge problem. And anyone who works on a university campus knows that those statistics are way off.
Well, I mean, so she makes this speech, and, you know, I wanted to just give you, so Frederick Hess wrote for the National Review, and he said that her speech, quote, reflected a welcome regard for the statute after years of executive branch adventurism, and more important, a much-needed push to begin correcting for the kangaroo court insanity that the Obama administration ideologues unleashed on college campuses.
Well, part and parcel of the problem here is this continued assault on the record of the Obama administration, when in fact Title IX goes back well before the Obama administration. What the Obama administration did was to simply, in response to what was happening on college campuses, question the extent to which universities were prepared to deal with these allegations. And again, this is not a problem that just materialized in the last few years. As I mentioned to you, we can go back to 1972 to talk about the application of Title IX in these particular cases. What you really have here, though, is, and I think the best explanation of it that I've heard thus far, is someone who said that you have this kind of push on the right to protect these privileged young men who have been unfairly targeted by Title IX. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not calling them rapists. We're not saying that they're, you know, young men who've been accused of sexual assault. We're just trying to paint this, or they're just trying to paint this picture of these young men as being falsely accused and having been denied due process because of this so-called legislative overreach on the part of the Obama administration. The fact of the matter, again, is that nothing could be further from the truth. Universities, for the most part, come up with these dictates themselves. Mm-hmm. There's certainly other provisions that warrant a deep look into the way that sexual misconduct cases are handled on college campuses. But ultimately, at the end of the day, universities and institutions of higher education are responsible for the safety of the students, and you cannot take accusations of sexual assault lightly. One could argue that if you look back at the pre-1970s into the 70s into the 80s, there were any number of assaults that went underreported, that the nature of the crime itself is one that requires these type of strenuous provisions, and that's why you know, again, the right calling it overreach, but those in the know, those who work on campuses, those who have witnessed the problems inherent in this, recognize this is a major problem.
But what are, I mean, okay, so, you know, whatever, devil's advocate or whatever it is, how, what about the, quote, falsely accused? Is that, I mean, we know it happens in our criminal justice system. Should we not be concerned about the falsely accused?
We absolutely should be. In fact, the old kind of thing about rape cases at the turn of the century was that rape was an accusation easily made and once made hard to disprove. It puts a huge burden on the person who has been accused of a sexual assault. On college campuses, that's augmented by the fact that you have, again, access to drugs and alcohol. Young people kind of, for the first time, freeing, kind of experimenting, so on and so forth. And so when these accusations are made, it's very easy for one to come along and to say, well, this is just a case of, you know, kind of youthful adventurism, or, you know, as Betsy DeVos suggested, or Candace Jackson, excuse me, suggested, breakup sex or drunken sex or whatever it may be. And then one person has regrets in the morning. The fact of the matter is, though, that there's plenty of evidence, there are plenty of studies to indicate the depth to which young women did not report, and still in large numbers don't report, sexual assaults on college campuses, that what we were doing was creating a culture where young women on campuses across this country were potentially victims of a crime where they could not get any kind of would not have any sense that they would be supported, believed, and that they could not get any support. And universities, in trying to, you know, ferret out what the best direction to go in, have erred on the side of making the case that there's a zero tolerance policy with regard to these types of cases. Now, are there falsely accused people? Absolutely. In the criminal justice system, not just in what happens on college campuses with regard to this. But the question that parents have to ask, the question that students have to ask, the question that university administrators have to ask, the question that Americans have to ask is, what level are we willing to go to ensure the safety of the majority? And that requires these type of stringent provisions and this zero tolerance policy that says, if you find yourself in that position, the university has a responsibility to make sure that the offender isn't in a position to terrorize other people.
Let's do the history part first, like you just said. So the idea that this is an Obama-led type of thing is, first of all, is nonsense, because we're talking about all the way, this is part of the amendments to the original 1963 General Education Provisions Act that was amended in 72, where we put in Title IX. So President Obama probably didn't have a lot to do with this in 1972.
President Obama had nothing to do with this. In fact, this is it's almost embarrassing, Tim, to watch the president continually talk about his electoral victory over Hillary Clinton, to talk about beating Obama. I mean, it's just that, you know, famously, when Michael Jordan was inducted into the Hall of Fame, people criticized his speech because they said, you know, he talked about all the people with the teammates of his who hadn't performed and all the people he beat and so on and so forth. And someone wrote in Sports Illustrated, I can't remember who it was, you know, you won already. You know, you already won. The president's won the big prize. You're the president of the United States. At what point do you start talking and thinking about your own legacy? At what point do you shift and transition away from being concerned about talking about your victory in the election and starting to be concerned about your own legacy? And one cannot build a legacy simply on dismantling the work of others. One can't build a legacy on spreading lies and misinformation and trying to tie everything to what your predecessor has done. And most importantly of all, one can't build a legacy essentially eroding fundamental basic human rights. DACA is a good example of that. You know, you can't roll back these protections for dreamers and pretend in some way that somehow is advancing American political values, civil and political values. You can't roll back Title IX and suggest that in any way you are advancing American civil values. They just don't compute.
Well, you know what? That's why we have historians like the dean at St. Thomas, Dr. Yehuru Williams, talking to Busted Pencils, because we need you people who look back and say, wait a minute, here's the reality of the situation. Here's what happened. Here's where it is. Here's where it's going. No matter what somebody is trying to tell you is happening right now, here's the history and here's where it is. I mean, sounds to me like some of the other thing is that Donald Trump is trying to undo history.
Well, I think certainly. And the irony of that is we've seen these Confederate statues coming down across the country. You've seen the Trump administration pleading to history and saying, well, we should preserve these statues as a symbol of our history. And yet this is an individual who on various occasions has demonstrated a deep disregard for even the basic facts associated with, you know, important historical events in not just the United States, but in world history. And I say that only because when you get somebody like Candace Jackson, that infamous New York Times interview where she complained about 90% of campus sexual assault being, overblown episodes of drunken sex or breakup sex. When you get a education secretary in Betsy DeVos with no experience who basically cavalierly makes these comments about Title IX when it's clear that she doesn't understand the history of Title IX herself. And when you have a president who is advancing that agenda, you have to be very concerned. It's not just the lack of knowledge of history, but the fact that the consequences of these, the efforts of these individuals will have real and lasting consequences that will not easily be undone. The only thing that could be fairly laid at the feet of the Obama administration is that in 2011, the administration sent out a letter from the Department of Education's Civil Rights Office that essentially said, if universities did not increase efforts to investigate and adjudicate allegations of sexual assault, then the government would explore, that the universities would risk the loss of federal funds.
Right.
That is not a mandate in any way. What that is the government trying to ensure that universities are protecting the rights of citizens who matriculate on those campuses. So
it's sad, but more and more I'm not surprised by this administration, by the people in the administration. You know, again, the unqualifiedness in Betsy DeVos and where they're coming from. But so next TV show, when will you be popping up in my living room?
I will be on CNN is doing a retrospective on 1968, and I'll be a part of that.
Yahuru, hey man, thanks for busting pencils with us.
Always good talking to you, Tim, and I love busted pencils. I'll be listening.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
She's the previous Associate Dean of Students at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. She is now the current Dean of Students at Edgewood College in Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Dean Heather Harbach.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Heather, you're the Dean of Students. You're dealing with issues that deal with students. Betsy DeVos is our new Secretary of Education, and she's out fixing the world, righting the wrongs, putting things right, and making sure that the accused of sexual assault are held up and made sure that they get their fair treatment.
Absolutely.
And you're good with this, right? I mean, this,
totally.
So this is something that should be you're concerned about.
Absolutely.
Because you deal directly with this.
Yes. And especially in my previous position, I investigated cases of sexual violence and currently also both support as well as potentially investigate cases in my current role.
Okay.
And it is very concerning because, her claims of brokenness and injustices for the accused just are completely out of place.
So you don't see that. I mean, we're going to talk in your practice now, you've only been at the new position here at Edgewood for a few months, but baseless claims of, I mean, this millions of falsely accused men out there with lives ruined is an exaggeration?
I have 100%.
Okay.
I have investigated many cases.
Okay.
And
well, you've been part of an investigation.
Yes.
Into sexual misconduct.
Yes.
That Title IX required you to investigate.
Yes,
okay.
It did.
So you actually know what you're talking about.
Yes, I hope that I do.
Wow, that's something nice. I mean, Betsy DeVos just has a whatever.
Right. I've actually done the work.
You've actually done this work.
Yes,
awesome. So
done this work.
Not awesome that you've had to do this work, but you actually, again, we'd say, know what you're talking about. So this falsely accused and stuff like this, we should be troubled because of the possibility of of what this could do. Is that what you're saying?
You know, I think that any professional that works with student conduct, student misconduct, and works with investigations of this nature, those that I know hold themselves to really high ethical and professional standards. And for someone to come in and say that so many students are wronged is a slap in the face of the hardworking professionals that are there committed to students on all sides of the issue, both the complainants and respondents. And I know myself and my colleagues and those that I worked with really took it as an important part of our job to make sure all students' rights were respected, all students.
What about this? I even heard this, is that this gives you and your position a break from these burdensome federal regulations that were taking you away from doing your real job.
This was my real job.
It still is.
Yes. And so it's our federal compliance. Sure, there are rules and regulations that we need to follow, but they're there for a reason. And anyone that's doing their job and doing it well and has the proper support from their administration and their colleagues, you're able to do that. And really at the heart of this, it should be about supporting students and their opportunities of education. And so if we have a student who's been a victim and who's been victimized by violence, then we want to make sure that that's addressed and not ignored. So whatever Betsy may say, I will say that I know myself and colleagues, we're still going to be out there supporting students and we're still going to be doing our jobs. Because of all the investigations that I've had, I've never heard of someone not having their due process rights, not having access to advisors, not having processes clearly explained to them, and not been met with a neutral investigator. It's a commitment we have.
Right. So the commitment is to make sure due process.
Yes,
is
absolutely.
There. It's an American value.
Yes. The right, your notice of your charges and the right to respond. That's what due process is. Sometimes people think due process is all of these steps, 50 different steps, this and that. No, it's a right to know what you're being charged with and the right to respond to that. And absolutely, that's essential to student conduct.
I saw one conservative commentator, Frederick Hess, talked to the fact, and I'm paraphrasing him now, but he said this will undo the kangaroo court system that has developed because of Title IX.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you're looking at me with this face of going, we didn't have a kangaroo court system.
We didn't hop around hearing cases, that's for sure. That phrase, it makes me laugh. I met many times with attorneys who, while they were very skilled in the area of criminal law that they worked with outside of higher education, many of them were not experienced nor skilled in the area of student conduct, which is different. We aren't a criminal justice process. We don't intend to be. That's not the nature of the work that we're doing. We're looking at behavior in the educational setting. And so coming in and calling it a kangaroo court almost is a sense of what I would take as arrogance of like only we as attorneys are able to do this. And that's not, as student kind of professionals, that's not what we were trying to be. We were trying to be there to address behavior in the college environment.
Well, and there are sometimes misbehaviors on college campuses.
Absolutely. And and going to school right now, going into higher education, it's not a right, it's a privilege. And we want to make sure that students know that we have expectations for them because our community has expectations of them. And we want to make sure that when students come on campus that they're coming to pursue their academic pursuits and they're not being distracted by someone who's being disruptive to their educational environment.
What do you say to a student who may have viewed this and said, wow, I feel not as safe as I think I should have, or this is, I'm not protected. Maybe I better not say anything.
I would strongly encourage that student to come and talk to whomever they can on their campus, like their Dean of Students office or their counseling center, women's resource centers, LGBTQ resource centers, close confidants, their faculty. Come to talk to someone, because I can tell you, we're still there, we're still supporting students, and we still will be following through with these investigations, regardless of whatever kangaroo court we're being given.
So Betsy DeVos has not stopped Heather, the Dean of Students,
no.
and other Deans of Students across the country in these roles from actually doing the job of Title IX enforcement, or whatever you want to say. You guys are still on the job.
Yes, we're still here. We're still supporting students. We're still making sure the students have access to education. And if you do something you're not supposed to do and you hurt another student, that behavior will be addressed.
Well, that sounds not very kangaroo-ish.
No, it isn't.
Why kangaroos though? Why they gotta pick on this poor guy?
I don't know. Right. They seem pretty nice to me. I don't know.
As long as they stay down under, as they say.
Right.
Well, Heather Harbaugh, Dean of Students at Edgewood College, thank you so much for what we say here, busting pencils with us.
Absolutely.
Time now to enter Cone's zone on Busted Pencils with Alfie Cone. Alfie, you wrote a piece at alfiecone.org called Raising an Un-Trump. How do you raise an un-Trump child, Alfie?
Well, the question is, how do you explain to a child who knows what's going on in Washington that all the things you told him or her not to do are the very things that got this person into the White House? Someone who is a vulgar bully, a misogynist who boasts about grabbing women's private parts, somebody who's so desperately needy for attention that he has to lash out vituperatively at anyone who questions or challenges him, someone who, in short, is the very opposite of the kind of human being we hope our children will become.
Right.
So there's sort of a short range and a long range feature to this. The short range feature is, how do you explain Donald Trump, this vile bully, to your children? And there's actually a new book that just came out on this exact topic, a series of essays called How Do I Explain This to My Kids? Parenting in the Age of Trump. But I'm interested in, for the purpose of this article that I wrote, and maybe even a book that I might write, in the long-range question, which is, how can we use Trump as a counterexample? How do we do what I call negative learning, where you take careful notes of what this man is like and then do exactly the opposite in the way that you raise your own children? So I began making a list of his personality features and then in each case thought about what research and developmental experts have to teach us about helping your kids turn out differently.
Right.
So in other words, it's very general and to some extent familiar ideas of parenting, just reframed in terms of raising an un-Trump.
I'm with you. So what are four and maybe more things we can do?
Trump sees everybody as a potential rival. For him, it's not about doing well. It's about defeating others.
Right. It's a winningness, a competitiveness.
It's a toxic competitiveness, absolutely. And he's such a great example of what I've been writing about for years, proving that competitiveness doesn't come from strength, but from desperate insecurity. It's precisely the people who doubt on some level that they're any good, who have to keep triumphing over others in a desperate attempt to prove their own worth. It never works, of course, but it doesn't stop because it's built on deficit. And so we want our kids to feel secure enough in themselves that they don't have that need to triumph over, to beat people, but instead to view others they come across as potential allies. And that requires not only equipping them with that unconditional sense of self-regard, but also with the concrete skills of how to collaborate. And boy, is that a ready-made opportunity for teachers to create classrooms that feel like caring communities and to have kids spend most of their time in pairs and small groups learning with and from one another and, one hopes in the long run, viewing others as allies instead of as victims or rivals.
Boy, you talk about, I mean, you've been writing about this competitiveness, and I think about that. I don't think people think deeply, though, about the fact where you just put this competitiveness in the actual demonstration that Trump puts on about the fact that this is a need to validate something that he himself has no confidence in.
Yes, that's right. Namely himself. But, I mean, we see weaker echoes of that same psychopathology in other people who sometimes, to my astonishment, even boast about their own competitiveness, which I think is basically like acknowledging, you know, I've got a substance abuse problem. They don't know how much they're revealing when they talk about, when they say they're competitive, they're saying, what, it's not the interest in whatever it is I do. It's not the task or the value in itself and becoming better at it that interests me. It's a desperate need to have other people fail so I can succeed, which is what competition means by definition. I mean, that's not just some sick or perverted version of it. Competition means you and I both try to do something, but we can't both get it. So I have to make you fail in order that I can look good. And sometimes that happens because the rules of the game are set up that way. And other times it happens because of the psychological profile of the people involved.
I just wondered, though, about this last point in here, this avoiding a hunger for money, greed and something like that. Is there more to that part that we want to...
Yeah, we don't want our kids, hopefully, to just see life about acquiring more stuff, let alone, again, to have this psychopathology where they have to slap their name on everything they own and then figure out how much more stuff than everybody else they can get, you know, which describes Trump. I mean, you don't have to be a psychologist to look at this profile and say, oh, my God, what is wrong with this man? You know, so if we just raise kids who aren't wealth addicts, as one sociologist put it, you know, and they look at somebody like Trump who keeps buying more stuff and says, mine is the best, the biggest, the goldest, whatever. You know, they won't look at this with envy or admiration. They'll look at him with pity. Mm. And there's this fascinating line of research. Tim Kasser at Knox College and Rich Ryan at the University of Rochester and others have been doing this for more than 25 years. And they have shown across cultures that the more young adults value getting rich or famous, the more that's a priority for them, the worse shape they're in psychologically speaking. It doesn't matter how much money they actually have. It matters how important this is to them as a goal. And the more focused they are on material acquisition, the more likely it is that they report having low subjective well-being. They're less happy. They're more likely to watch more TV, more likely to drink. Their lives are not in good shape. And some psychologists have found in developmental studies that the more financial success matters, the more likely they are to have had a parent who wasn't very nurturing. Mm. So they're trying to get security through money and stuff. Maybe Trump is like that, but that points the way to undoing that pathological pattern and the way we raise and teach our children.
Well, and there we come back to the conclusion, which is, you know, who knew that such a horrible man could give us an opportunity to possibly teach some virtue to our children and, quote, as you say, un-Trump them. Perfect. I wonder what Matt's mom would say about gender development in Title IX and Betsy DeVos.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask
her. Kids start to learn. They start to develop a gender identity. The majority of kids, not everyone, begin to develop a sense of whether they're a boy or a girl. Really pretty young, because their parents, their grandparents, all the same, coochie coochie, you're such a cute little girl, are saying these things to them when they're really little and just learning language. So if they're 2 or 3 years old, they start hearing that category name, oh, I'm a boy. And what does it mean? And then they kind of look at the world around them and see, well, who are boys and what do boys do, and start to kind of fill out that idea and that sense of themselves. In some cultures, there are very definite role definitions, so kids will see very definite roles, you know, in many countries played mm-hmm. by men and women, and that starts to fill out their idea. We have those here, but not as defined. But what we do have in the U.S. that's so influential is the media, which kids start getting on screens, unfortunately, when they're 1 and 2 and 3 years old and on through childhood, where there are very definite messages that they're getting about boys and girls that are very gender stereotyped.
Okay,
and have a big influence around the clothes they like, the toys they like, and there's, you know, really a tremendous amount of marketing to young kids that includes a lot of gender definition. So they're very influenced by it, and a lot of the stuff that comes across tells them girls and boys are different. If you go into a toy store, you'll see aisles for girls and aisles for boys. It didn't used to be like this 30 years ago, but it sure is now. Actually, since the 1980s, it's been like this.
Right. So, and I have a girl and a boy, and I know when I used to take, now they're 14 and 17, and would never uh-huh. admit to going to a toy store at this point in their lives. But yeah, we used to have to go, you know, split up, and you go down, you go there with Lacey, and you go there with Luke, and we'll meet up at the end of the toy shopping.
Exactly. This is the thing. How does it affect girls and boys and their relationships to start getting messages early on that they're different, and especially if there's any kind of discrimination attached to it? Mm-hmm. A lot of the messages that both girls and boys see about girls are quite sexualized, even with little girls, you know, images little girls see. There's a lot of dolls that look sexualized, the Bratz dolls that are very popular, the Barbie dolls. They're like, I'm not sure why you have a figure for, you know, a Miss America kind of woman on a doll for a five-year-old.
Right.
Anyway, it's not, in other words, baby dolls are more appropriate for little girls and boys because you're practicing parenting and nurturing behavior. You know, you're not practicing being a sexy teenager. So and plus a lot of little kids are seeing a lot of screen media that sexualizes women anyway. I mean, my point is that division of the genders begins really early, mm-hmm. and it's kind of a separation, and often there's an objectification.
Is there any type of, you know, hierarchy being placed in that, or is that, you know, not so sure? Or, you know, because you talk about gender roles, and so if I'm sexually objectifying, learning that at a very young age,
yeah,
and so I'm a little boy, what is that telling me about my expectations as a behavior as a little boy, or am I asking too deep of a question?
No, I think it starts to influence relationships between little boys and little girls from a very young age, and you'll see discrimination arising very, very young. And this is why, it's funny, you and I were talking earlier about the importance of teacher education. Well, one big thing that happens in early childhood education is teachers do a lot of work around this.
Hmm.
They do consciousness raising around their own sense of self as a man or a woman, and also what is the way to create a classroom that gives the maximum opportunity to reach full human potential for every little boy and every little girl? And teachers learn many, many things that they can do in the classroom that are going to encourage little boys to play out nurturing behavior, and to have it be okay to play with dolls, to read books about that, to encourage little girls to be very robust and to build with blocks and building materials. Because kids are going to naturally select into these gender-defined things if you just leave them alone in a preschool.
Mm-hmm.
You have to actually intervene as a teacher and encourage girls and boys to play together and find interesting problems to set up for them that are going to draw both girls and boys into the block area or into theme play in the imagination area. And, you know, there's a lot that teachers can do to kind of break down these stereotypes and help kids understand the value of playing with each other across genders. But if teachers don't do that, you'll see a lot of gender-defined behavior starting, you know, with 3- and 4-year-olds.
So if we do early childhood extremely well, maybe we can, in 20 to 30 years, talk about some relooking at Title IX. However, I'd say until then, this sexual, whether it's gender assault, gender discrimination, sexual assault, there's still a role.
Oh, there's definitely a role for the law to play.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
That's all the time we have. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.